She just graduated from the Williams Mitchell School of Law last May and has a BA in Political Science and Sociology of Law, Criminology, and Deviance, Senator Benson, from the U of M. She's originally from Rochester and has a background in administrative work and customer service. So it's really a pleasure. This is her second full-time day on the job. Can you imagine throwing her into this?
I think she's overqualified.
I think she's doing great, and I am just tickled to have her, and so welcome, Jenna. And Nikki Blander, she took a great job with the Mayo Clinic, so she's moving to Rochester, and so that's what you like to see. And with that, we'll go through the schedule afterwards, but Senator Benson, Senate File 1906.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and before I begin, I don't know if someone has an update on Senator Kubley. Who is not with us? Has anyone?
Senator
Dibble. We were at caucus, and it doesn't sound good, but let Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I guess he's still in very critical condition.
He's still in critical condition.
He's been sedated. So not expected to be conscious, but they'll know more tonight.
I hope everybody has a chance to say some prayers and spend some time with Senator Kubley and his family and sending them warm thoughts and prayers. Thank you for Senator Benson because he was very active and he loved this committee very much. And so we'll be thinking of today in this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 1906 is very simple, but not without controversy. It simply removes language that would limit hydroelectric power with a capacity of less than 100 megawatts from being excluded from the renewable energy standard. And I want to be clear, this didn't come from a lobbyist or a special interest group. It was from reading of statutes and seeing this language that I was baffled as a layperson and now as a legislator that hydroelectricity was not considered a renewable. I've learned a lot of the history of how this came to be, and I'm not here to refight old fights, and it's not because they weren't significant at the time, and it's not because they didn't matter, but it's because I believe significant work has been done to resolve those issues, and we are in a different place for energy policy and are ready to have a discussion about what is apparently a small change but will have a big impact on stakeholders. Members of the alternative energy community are rightfully concerned about the impact this legislation will have on the future of their business, and I acknowledge those concerns. Exclusion of certain types of hydroelectric production, tax credits, and other legislative preferences have created a protected environment for certain renewable sources, and they have flourished, as we've heard many times in this committee. The provider tax credit gives a market advantage to certain renewable energy sources, and existing power purchase agreements will provide a steady stream of cash flows that give long-term financial stability in a maturing renewables market. Now that our renewable industries are gaining strength, it is time for us to move back some of the protections and let them thrive in an open market. We all hope for Minnesota's economy to grow and for energy demands to increase. And while we are leaving the renewable energy standard in place as a signal that we should encourage and foster alternative energy sources, however, as the PTC expires, our market will experience the unsubsidized cost of wind. And we have seen in our reports that this could be quite expensive. To keep our energy rates low, we must keep all our options on the table to protect residential and business ratepayers as we go forward. I've spoken with many energy providers, and they do not oppose the addition of hydropower to the RES. In fact, many co-ops have welcomed this action in the past. We've heard in our RES hearings that the RES did not specifically increase costs for all generation types. However, as I said before, when the producer tax credit expires, the cost of new power purchase contracts will likely go up. Our combined goal is a reliable, reasonably priced electricity that is respectful of our environment. And with this bill in mind, I would like to send a signal that Minnesota's energy policy is adjusting to be welcoming to business and protective of ratepayers. With that, members, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Benson. And let's see, do we have a quorum? Not yet. So we don't have a
don't know if the A1 amendment at all changes what I have to say. So I'm not.
Well, that's a very good point. And that is, would you, how about if we pass that out and not vote on it yet? Would that be okay?
I'm not aware of any amendment.
Okay. Well, we should pass this out and let you know. But believe me.
That's brownie.
Madam Chair, I apologize if I should have checked in with Mr. Fuller before my testimony today.
We'll get this right. Basically, the amendment, Senator Benson says, it takes on page 2, line 3, after the period, that whole section, that whole sentence there, the total retail electric. Is that something that is favorable? Would you like
yes.
this passed out? Okay. Super.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that Senator Brown was going to offer that amendment.
That's okay.
Okay.
You can offer it. If all right. You can do it. Yeah. Still don't have a quorum, so we can't vote on it yet, so we'll wait. But do give Mr. Gackle and Mr. Sokolsky a chance to look at it. Would you still like to testify? Or
sure,
are you in favor?
Yeah.
Okay.
If I understand the amendment correctly, Madam Chair, and I don't know that I do, so maybe I don't think it materially changes our testimony. But maybe after some discussion, yeah. So I will. I'll just get into my...
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Mr. Gackle, before you start, I think we're going to have Mr. Fuller give an explanation what exactly this amendment does with the WAPA power.
Madam Chair, it's just as you said. It's that sentence that begins on page 2, line 3, total retail electric sales. You can remember last year we had that WAPA discussion about what should count and what shouldn't because they were getting things from WAPA, Western Area Power Administration. It was larger than 100, so it wasn't counted in their sales. So they didn't have to get that percentage of renewables. That, since the bill now gets rid of the limit, which was the reason why we had this language in here, then the reason for having this language leaves as well. So it's proportional.
It's proportional.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Okay.
Mr. Gackle.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Josh Gackle, and I'm with Wind on the Wires. Thank the committee and the chair for the opportunity to share our concerns with Senate File 1906. First of all, just a brief reminder of who Wind on the Wires is. We are a nonprofit advocacy organization based here in St. Paul, but we work throughout 9 states in the upper Midwest, from the Dakotas over east to Indiana and Michigan. We focus our efforts here on wind and transmission issues, working on regulatory, technical, and policy arenas of bringing more wind power to market in the Midwest. We represent nearly 40 member organizations and companies, including turbine manufacturers, wind developers, both large and small, farm and agricultural organizations, tribal organizations, clean energy organizations, and others. Many of these companies hire hundreds of Minnesota workers each time they build a wind farm here in Minnesota. And that's going to be the gist of my testimony today, talking about the jobs and economic development impact that this bill will have here in Minnesota. For several years, and long before my time at Wind on the Wires, our organization has worked closely with the legislature and current and former administrations to help ensure that electricity from wind is a long-term, stable, cost-effective, and reliable source of energy for all Minnesotans. Minnesota has been a leader in this area and can and should continue to lead. Currently, Minnesota is the nation's fifth largest wind energy producing state with over 2,700 megawatts of wind installed. It represents approximately 10% of the generation fleet here in Minnesota. This segment of our electric fleet has resulted in approximately 2,000 to 3,000 jobs, approximately $8 million in payments to landowners, and approximately $7.6 million in payments to county governance and other local units of government. The positive economic development and jobs impact in greater Minnesota is a success story that can and should continue.
What's your point?
From our perspective, the impacts of Senate File 1906 would threaten the future growth of this industry and the benefits that have been realized by farmers, cities and towns, counties, schools, and local businesses throughout greater Minnesota. And I want to be clear, we're not here to say that hydroelectricity, by definition, is not renewable. Clearly it is. However, the long-term policy of this state, going back to the early 2000s, when you first adopted the renewable energy objective, has been to incentivize the development of renewable projects here in Minnesota. to ensure that the benefits that I discussed earlier related to jobs and economic development occur here in Minnesota. That's the reason for the current 100 megawatt cap, and it really is not an argument over whether or not hydro is a renewable source of electricity. What we've learned since the enactment of the 25 by 25 standard nearly 5 years ago, over 5 years ago now actually, it was February of 2007, is that for the most part the state's utilities are meeting this requirement reliably and cost effectively. You had that hearing in here a few weeks ago with the rate impact reports. And I should note that current law in no way prevents utilities from accessing hydroelectricity. Just a few weeks ago, Minnesota Power announced plans to construct a transmission line in northern Minnesota in order to purchase more hydro from Canada. As currently planned and under current law, this hydro resource would be in addition to and benefiting Minnesota Power's current wind generation, and this is good. We feel strongly that the state should maintain this policy and not allow large out-of-state hydro to displace the jobs and economic benefits of Minnesota's next wind farm. Thank you, members. I'll take any questions, and also Adam Sikolsky with Iberdrola would like to add a couple specific instances.
Well, I think Mr. Sikolsky will have you testify and then have questions afterwards. And for the record, we do have a quorum.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Adam Sikolsky. I develop wind farm projects for Iberdrola Renewables. We're a large wind power development ownership and management company that owns 550 megawatts of existing operating wind projects here in Minnesota, as well as thousands of megawatts of additional wind farms across the United States.
Most of them in my district.
Most of them in your district.
My district.
And Senator Magnus's district. I completely agree. Iberdrola Renewables completely agrees with Wind on the Wire's comments and testimony here today. I wanted to give just a brief synopsis of what the peak of a construction project for a wind farm looks like. A wind farm takes 3, 4, 5 years, sometimes now with transmission backlogs, 6 or 7 years to plan and to obtain transmission access to the grid. In that time, we spend millions of dollars on pre-development activities such as MISO queue requests and studies for transmission upgrades that precede the actual wind farm project, things that need to be paid for years in advance so they can get built and ready for a wind farm project to interconnect to the grid. We're out doing road assessments, permits that take a year or more from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission at great cost, hiring local contractors to do engineering, soils, environmental wetland delineations, wildlife studies. These projects need a multiple-year project development cycle. In that project development cycle, we need stable policy and regulatory environments to ensure that we're going to have a chance to put a bid in to try to get a power purchase agreement for a project with a utility. Senate File 1908 unfortunately upsets that stable regulatory environment. The bill creates a tremendous amount of uncertainty as to what the market for the renewable energy standard will be in future years. It reduces the economic development benefits you might see in Minnesota, in southwestern Minnesota, in western Minnesota, where wind farms are currently built, owned, and operated, by potentially eliminating the opportunity for these projects to move forward. Now you say, well, you know, wind farm only might employ, you know, a dozen employees once it's up and running. But during construction, a $200 to $250 million wind farm needs 400 employees at peak to help build that wind farm project. Those people come from Minnesota. They're people with companies like Mortenson, like Blattner, like Barr Engineering, like Anderson Truck Service. Multiple people in supply chain from Minnesota helping to put these large projects together. Those economic development benefits flow through at the local district level, where you're building the wind farm, all the way through to the Twin Cities and people throughout the supply chain across the state. The state has a real, maybe not, it's not maybe the center of wind farm development in the country, but certainly one of the major regional hubs, on par with a hub like Delta Airlines has in the state. It's where we have a lot of people, professionals, who know how to put these projects together, who are employed doing just that here in the state of Minnesota. This bill might shut some of that down. Most importantly here, this bill would allow for out-of-state existing hydro resources, projects that have been in the ground for years, projects that may have been in the ground prior to the renewable energy standard even being enacted, to qualify towards the renewable energy standard in the state. That takes away opportunities for new projects that would be built in-state, that would be built by Minnesota people, Minnesota contractors, Minnesota employees. It would take away that opportunity for landowner payments and new taxes to be paid. We pay production taxes to counties and townships throughout the state. I've personally seen the positive impacts by having successful projects built and put into the ground in Minnesota. You see counties like Jackson County, a county where I spent a lot of time, where our company has been very successful in building wind farms, where some of our competitors have been successful. That county, because of wind farm production tax revenue, is cutting taxes for their other property tax payers, for local citizens. They're using some of the money to fund new infrastructure developments, such as roads and bridges, that through our wind farm developments we found are substandard. This new money is helping to fix roads that are in disrepair. It's helping to fix bridges that are falling apart. Those economic development benefits, those positive benefits to the communities through Minnesota, are going to be reduced. Those opportunities will be reduced by passing this bill. So we ask for your opposition to this bill, to either lay it over or to defeat it here today, because it really does reduce the overall positive economic benefits that you're going to find from renewable development here in Minnesota. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Skolsky. Any questions for Mr. Gackle or Mr. Skolsky? The federal tax credit, production tax credit, is slated to not be renewed, or hopefully it will be renewed. That, I would assume, too, would have a tremendous effect on the industry. Can you explain a little bit about that and the efforts on the federal level? Because that would be devastating.
Sure. Josh, do you want to say
it? Maybe broadly I can just say, Madam Chair, that yes, that is our national partner on wind energy advocacy, the American Wind Energy Association. That is certainly their number one issue right now, is trying to get that production tax credit extended. Currently they're asking for a four-year extension, and I believe it's a WEA's position that at the end of 4 years they would be prepared to go to do without it. But there are certain market conditions right now that continue to make it necessary for wind farms to have access to that credit, particularly low natural gas and other just overall general economic conditions that have affected the marketability of a wind project. But certainly something that we're focused on and hoping continues. And I should say that, you know, that that's an issue that is very popular and supported by Republican congressional members across the country as well. Just nearby in Iowa, Northwest Iowa, one of the most conservative Republican members of Congress, Steve King, who is very fiscally conservative, but he has been a very vocal advocate for continuation of the PTC. So it's not a political issue. It doesn't seem to be in Washington. It's just very difficult to get anything done there. But we hope it continues. And there are a couple opportunities, I think, upcoming through different bills that might be moving in Washington. But at this point, yes, it's uncertain.
Mm-hmm. Skolsky.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, absolutely, the production tax credit and its upcoming expiration does create tremendous uncertainty in wind power development. These, as I said, are long lead time projects. The production tax credit will affect pricing on everything on a wind farm, but most principally wind turbines themselves, which are the bulk of the cost. You know, the production tax credit, this is not the venue to really lobby for the production tax credit, but it takes a lot of money to put a wind farm together. Some of the money that flows through to wind farm by an outside investor would probably be parked offshore, but for the PTC. And so by using the PTC as an incentive, capital partners are able to put money into wind farms, investments in the United States of America that might not otherwise go forward without such an incentive. So it's been an important stimulus for wind and for moving money that would maybe not be invested in such a manner otherwise.
Yeah, and as you said, this is really not the venue to talk about that. However, that is part of the equation, part of the, and that's what we need to have is really good discussion about all of our renewables. So, Senator Jungbauer, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess to either testifier, but it gets a little bit away from the bill, but I think it when we're talking about all these issues, it does come into play. And I know Arbidrola does wind farms in a lot of areas, but you mentioned about lead time. What I'd read a lot of stuff about lead time, but nobody really got into what is it? What is lead time on units today?
Mr. Skulski?
On a wind farm here in the upper Midwest, in the what we call the MISO service territory, and I think on Tuesday or last Thursday you heard from MISO, so you're probably all up to speed on who MISO
is.
There's
a quiz on it.
They do, but that's the regional market here, and that's the regional transmission operator, and it's the people we need to talk to and get permission from in order to connect our wind farm to the grid. It's our road to market.
So,
and there's a toll to pay for that road to market, and there's capacity on the system like a toll road. Unfortunately, with the way things are right now at MISO, it can take. I've got projects that are in Group 5 in MISO that we requested interconnection service 2007, 2006, and we still don't have a number. What's it going to cost us? When can we go online 100% with our machines?
Senator Jungler.
Madam Chair, Mr. Sikulski, so 2006, 2007, you said. So assuming once you had approval and you had costs and it looked like the numbers were right, then from date of ordering of actual units, turbines, how long would it take to put together something? So we as a committee kind of understand, you know, in terms of time frame, what does it take to put these together, and understanding, you know, the tax credits you're still looking for, production tax credits, and comparing it to other things, and when you're making those, you know, worries about counting old hydro and stuff. I mean, I think we need to understand a little bit about time frame as we're making these considerations.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, putting together a wind farm, once you have the basic pieces in place, you've got your land leased, you have your transmission available, and you know how much it's going to cost to interconnect. You're able to procure turbines fairly quickly. You need to procure them probably a year to 9 months in advance, depending on the manufacturer and their supplies and demand. The other big piece, Senator Jungbauer, is the main high-voltage transformer you're using. In these cases, if you're interconnecting at a transmission level voltage of 115, 161 kV, 345 kV, those main transformers where you're taking 100 or 200 megawatts of energy and then stepping it up to very high transmission level voltages, those units take anywhere from 9 months to a year to, first of all, you have to design them, to put them on order, bid them out, and then they're manufactured and shipped to the site. It's not something that there's just not custom 345 generators or transformers just out on the shelf. You have to order them, and they do take quite a while to come in. They're not something you can deliver in the middle of the summer or in the middle of the winter sometimes when the roads are icy. They need some fairly specialized conditions because they're extremely heavy, and you need a lot of infrastructure in place just to get them to the project. A project only takes about 9 months to build. May 1st to December 31st, basically, and you can get something done. But those long lead times come in the transmission world mostly, and how long it takes you to procure land. In some cases, you can do it faster. But this part of the MISO region, it's as you've heard, there's a backlog on transmission right now, and there's a big traffic jam and not a lot of on-ramps without a long backup on them.
Senator Jumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Sikulski. Just to kind of, excuse me, to finish up then, so when you're talking about production tax credits or any kind of comparison to other renewable, it's a long time frame. So everything could fall apart if that production tax credit disappears or anything changes by the time you've got all those approvals. Is that what you're telling us, that, you know, if all of a sudden tomorrow you got the approval for to hook up, but production tax credit or something else changes, all that work up ahead just gets thrown to the side? Is that what you're kind of leading to?
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, I wouldn't say it gets completely thrown to the side, but it has a big impact. Clearly, if you have a production tax credit that's expiring at the end of the year, you're not going to go ahead and make a decision today to build a new project that's going to take a year to get a main transformer on. So it's It's as if the production tax credit right now is already expired for projects that haven't been approved for construction. If you called a Mortensen or a Blattner up and ask them what their order book looks like for next year, summer's construction season for wind farms, they're going to tell you there's probably nothing on the list, or maybe one project on the list instead of being fairly booked up.
Yeah.
So it has, you know, these things have a huge impact. The banking crisis a couple years ago had a huge impact. Not a permanent impact, not throwing everything to the side, but even temporary blips, temporary little potholes in the road can really cause you to slow down or divert your energy and attention to other other endeavors.
Thank you so much.
Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sikalski, I want to go back to, you talked about the new taxes that were being paid and how that benefits the counties. Could you elaborate on who's paying those taxes, if it's the providers or who exactly is paying those, and if that's a cost that's absorbed by them, or is it ultimately being paid by the ratepayers?
Mr. Sikalski.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown. It depends on the financial, depends on how the wind farm owner and operator is selling that product, that electric product. It could be that in some cases it's being accounted for in the power purchase agreement rate, which could be a Minnesota a PPA or a PPA with another utility in a different state. And there are examples of that here in Minnesota. If you're a merchant project, it's being borne by the company itself. So it all depends on who's buying the electricity and what the overall power contract states. So it could be a ratepayer in Minnesota, it could be a ratepayer in Indiana, it could be the wind farm owner-operator themselves, depending on, again, on how that worked out. In the end, it's a production tax payment in lieu of property tax. More stable source of revenue for the counties and townships involved, longer term, predictable for us, predictable for the community.
Thank you.
I know my counties love it. The county commissioners are very grateful. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if the testifiers could speak to the change in federal law as it relates to the interconnection and who pays for that connection to the grid and what that has done to the industry.
Mr. Sikalski or Mr. Gecko.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, I think what you're referring to is maybe what MISO has approved and or what MISO adopted and was approved by FERC, and that's the creation of these multi-value projects and that are high-voltage transmission projects. Right now there's about 17 of these 345 kV or higher projects that are hopefully going to be built throughout the Midwest. The big change in those MVP projects is the cost of those projects will be shared throughout the MISO footprint rather than in the exact location where they're built. The reason being that it was MISO's determination and it was FERC's determination when they approved the MVP projects that they had multiple beneficiaries. They didn't just benefit the local area that the transmission line existed in, but it ultimately reduces congestion throughout the entire Midwest grid. Allowing for more capacity, allowing for ultimately more cost-effective electricity to flow back and forth throughout the region. That's the reason why the cost is shared throughout the region.
Senator Howe.
Just follow up. Can you explain then how are those costs shared? Is there a formula for that, or how is that shared?
I wish MISO was here. Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I wish MISO was here again today to more fully explain that, but it's shared amongst the load-serving entities within the footprint, load-serving entities being the utilities who are providing the, and like any transmission project, even before multi-value projects, ultimately customers pay the bill for any new project.
Good. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gackle.
Thank you.
Mr. Sikalski. Thank you very much. Mr. Brickwitty.
Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce. We have some concerns about this bill. In 2007, when the legislature put the renewable energy standard in place. The point of the goal was to move the state from a point A to a point B. And this bill, as it's put together, would change the composition of what that point A starting point is from. It is, and has the potential to affect the state's ability to capture the value of moving that increment from point A to point B. A couple of quick notes about hydro in Minnesota. The current law captures all developed hydropower in the state and would allow for any hydropower that would come online in the state yet to be developed, and it would count, and a utility could count it towards its renewable energy goals. We heard testimony in the committee in January when the committee was talking about the renewable energy standard that Minnesota's utilities are cost effectively meeting their goals and seem to be on track to meeting their standards or their goals by 2025. And Madam Chair, there is nothing that prevents a utility from bringing out-of-state hydro onto or into the Minnesota market. We've seen the recent announcement from Minnesota Power that they plan to enter into an agreement with Manitoba Hydro to bring a large amount of hydropower into the state. And so nothing in current law prevents that from happening. But again, the value of the renewable energy standard and is to move the state from a point A to a point B. And we see if we are going to move the or change the composition of what counts that into that starting point, then the department would advocate for taking an examination of what that end goal would be. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Any questions for the department? Mr. Brickwitty, what would that end goal be if you had to adjust that? Could you say what it would be for the IOU or the other utilities?
Madam Chair, I don't have a specific number or percentage in mind for you right now, but I think that if you look at one decision in particular that the legislature made in 2007, you'll see that a different standard has already been applied. For example, Xcel Energy has a different goal.
Right.
Lots of folks talk about 20 or about our goals by 25, but Xcel Energy has a different goal because they started from a different point A from the rest of the utilities in the state. And so, again, if you were to count existing sources of hydro that are already in a utility's portfolio mix, that changes what their starting point would have been in 2007, and therefore we'd say we need to look at that. So, Madam Chair, I think it would depend, perhaps utility by utility, or we'd have to look at that. So I don't have a number for you right now or a percentage for you right now.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. McWeedy.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Noble, Fresh Energy.
Madam Chair, Michael Noble from Fresh Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify briefly. Fresh Energy was actively involved in working on this area of public policy for almost 7 years, from 2000 to 2007 when it became law. It had the support of, I think, 63 out of 66 members of the legislature and was signed by Governor Pawlenty. And the issue of whether hydropower should be counted toward as an eligible technology to meet the standard was actually one of the items that was fairly vigorously debated at the time. And the compromise that came out to count all hydropower that was smaller than 100 megawatts had the effect of including all the hydropower that was developed in Minnesota, all the hydropower that might ever be developed in Minnesota, all the hydropower that was serving Xcel system that had been developed on streams and rivers in Wisconsin and within Xcel service territory. But the main goal, as both of the testimonies have already suggested, is that the purpose of the bill was to diversify our mix of electricity. And at the time, all of our electricity, or nearly all of our electricity, came from coal and nuclear and large hydro. And the large hydro were dams that were built in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, both in Canada and in the Dakotas. And as other people have testified, there was no representation that they weren't renewable energy. Of course, large hydro is renewable energy. They were just acknowledged that we weren't trying to count them because, you know, a utility that had a lot of hydro would start the game on third base rather than everybody starting at home plate. So that was the primary purpose, was to diversify our energy mix and not count the large hydro, because that wasn't the idea behind the intent. As others have mentioned, all the utilities are on track. In the last 5 years, within the entire MISO footprint, we've gone from about 1,000 megawatts of wind power on the system, which one way to think about it is that's a capital investment of about $1.5 billion, which is what was in the system at the time. And now we have slightly over 10,000 megawatts in the system, which is a capital investment of almost $15 billion across the MISO footprint, which shows the kind of momentum that's been created within the MISO service territory by the Minnesota legislature's leadership. By far, in the MISO footprint, Minnesota has the strongest of the renewable energy standards. The state of Michigan has a ballot initiative this year. If it passes, they'll catch up with Minnesota, but they'll have been 5 years behind us. And Mr. Bennett is going to testify to the effect, again, of the impact on rates. Even though we're talking about an additional private, market-based, competitive, for-profit investment of $15 billion, it hasn't had a significant uptick on our electric bills because it's competitive with any of the other options that were available. So the net effect, if we do make large hydro eligible as one of the technologies to meet the renewable energy standard, is we would reduce the amount of renewable energy we otherwise have to acquire by about 10 to 20%. Some utilities would be able to reduce it even more because maybe they have 30% large hydro. Some utilities, you know, would literally be go from being on first base today to being on third base tomorrow. And so there really is no public benefit or no public policy purpose. And I think the main detriment of the bill would be a net loss of investment and net loss of employment and net loss of business activity from the private investment in renewable energy that would meet the standard that all the utilities say they're ably meeting and doing without much problem today. So that's why Fresh Energy opposes provision, and we hope that the legislature approaches this with some caution. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Noble. Any questions, Mr. Noble? Mr. Noble, you can stay up there. I think we're going to bring up Mr. Bennett right now. Mr. Bennett. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. For the record, Drew Bennett with the Isaac Walton League. I was actually considering testifying today, but then the other members who have already testified have really brought it back what we talked about earlier in January about how the rates have not come down or have not been impacted significantly by the RES. And so that was going to be my main point in the testimony, and that's why I didn't sign up to come up. But, you know, in general, now that I'm here.
I only think, have a few minutes here. Yeah. No, just 45 minutes, that's all.
I think, you know, the Isaac Walton League, a lot of our membership are avid hunters and fishers, and so, you know, this isn't necessarily part of what this committee always looks at, but, you know, we are always very interested in maintaining the waterways and things like that. So that part of large hydro hasn't really come up because it does impact our waterways. But in general, I think the league is very supportive of renewable energy. And if we move the qualifications for what our state should be looking at, we would support moving the goalposts farther back so that the laws continue to incentivize aggressive renewable energy adoption within the state. I can take questions, but it's really just supporting what other people have already said.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. Bennett, wouldn't this decrease job opportunities? Is that what I think I heard you say?
In the state of Minnesota?
Yes, that's what we're talking about, the state of Minnesota, not Canada.
Yes. I think in general that's true, because the parties that would qualify under this new statute are not located in the state of Minnesota. As Director Noble said, the potential for larger than 100 megawatts is not located inside of Minnesota. It's elsewhere. And so if we want to keep our energy dollars in the state, it would be detrimental to remove the cap.
Madam Chair.
Senator Benson?
Yeah, the biggest thing all of us at this table have talked about the last few months is job creation and job opportunities. And I'm concerned about the loss of the economic development opportunities that previous speakers talked about earlier and the decrease in job opportunities. That's you know, and why give credit when nobody's asking for it from the Canadian power companies? And who wants this legislation? I don't know. I haven't heard a thing. And I just think it would, in that area of jobs, that I'm on the jobs committee, used to chair it, that this is going to be a step backwards. So I don't know why we should benefit the Canadian producers. And things are going pretty good. I think there's a lot of research and development going on in this renewable stuff. And I think this would set us back a little bit. So I'm obviously, you know, I'm not in favor of this legislation at this time, and I don't know who it benefits. And again, it's a jobs thing with me.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. Senator Benson.
And Senator Rosen and Senator Metzen, to that point, this is about jobs. And we buy wind from Iowa wind farms, and the jobs were created in Iowa. Nobody has a problem with that. And we buy wind from South Dakota, and the jobs were in South Dakota, and nobody has a problem with that. And so the RES does, to some extent, protect a certain category of jobs in Minnesota. And we talk about how it hasn't necessarily impacted our electric rates. Those reports were inconclusive. Some said it did have an impact. Kinexis presented us with, was it almost $30 million of extra they had to spend in order to comply. That $30 million was passed on to ratepayers, small businesses, residents. That has an impact on jobs. Now, I've told many times the story of the broken window. If somebody breaks a window and you pay someone to fix it, that appears to have been a job created. But what we never measure is what would have been done with the money if the window hadn't been compelled to be repaired. And so while I honor the people who work hard creating jobs at wind farms, we must also understand that we don't see the jobs that aren't created. We're in a different time. When the RES was put into place, our economy was exploding. And we had some flexibility. Our electric production was, demand for electricity was growing. But it's time for us to step back and be where we're at and look at our energy policy again and decide what signal we're sending to the rest of the country, to businesses who might be moving here, to businesses who want to expand here. And our energy policy is critical to the message that we send out of this state. We are more expensive than our neighbors. We have a more stringent RES than most other states in the country. And this is a small step. And while I understand it is a huge impact on the wind industry, it is a small step in our energy economy when compared with the energy policy in the rest of the country.
Madam Chair, I guess I get a little of that, but in the hydro stuff from Canada, we considered when the legislation was passed because that's already was in the pipeline. And like Mr. Noble said, I think it was further along in third base. I think you're about 10 feet from home plate already with the hydro from Canada. So why are we trying to help them? And I think that's a little different than even the new development, even if it's another state, because that product, or if you will, the water, the hydro was already there for a long time. And the bio and the wind and the other issues were jump-started because of this legislation. And I just don't think we should give credit to, and that was thought out. That was talked about a long time ago, 8-10 years ago, why we're not giving credit for the Canadian stuff, because that we're going forward. So,
Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, to your point, I had never met anyone from Manitoba Power or any Canadian hydro company prior to yesterday. And this has been something I've been thinking about for a long time.
Okay.
And so I can assure you, nobody is coming out of the woodwork pushing me to do this. This was my issue and my question, and I hope to advocate well enough for it for this committee to pass it. And
Chair, just on that, I have I don't question your motives at all. I just question why you're doing this silly stuff. just kidding.
Senator Metzen, we're going to put you in a timeout chair. Wait, Senator Vandeveer.
Talk about silly. I think pretending somehow that hydro is not renewable, or because it is, it's because saying it is might bring a little bit of electricity from Canada into Minnesota. Our goal here is abundant, cheap, affordable, clean energy, isn't it? And we get that by allowing choice and competition as much as possible. So to sit here and have to manipulate to the extent that we're saying that water running downhill is not renewable, when it is, well, what the bill does is describe what's renewable. And to pretend that it isn't, to me, is really, that's really silly. So that's all I would say.
Madam Chair, nobody said that. I don't know, he's making that up. Nobody said that we didn't say that hydro is not renewable. I never said it.
Well, then, Mr. Chair,
I don't know what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, if silly applies to you, then take credit
hey,
for it.
This is not to be personal, Madam Chair, so I think he's over the line, but I'm just saying that I never said that. Hydro power is renewable. I mean, everybody at the table knows that. That's not, so don't put words in my mouth.
Senator Metzen, why would we not classify it as so?
It's already classified.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask Senator Benson, now that you've met the people from Manitoba, does it change your mind, though, that they would be qualify for this when we really want to encourage a lot more, a lot more hydro in our state? I mean, I would think that might make you rethink this bill. So my original question was, who brought this to you, or why did you think this was important? And if you did think it was important to have hydro, why wouldn't you want to encourage more people to do that?
Senator Benson. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I don't think I understand the question. I read the statute, thought it was something very practical that the average Minnesotan would look at and say, we should count this. It should be okay to have hydroelectricity counted as a renewable. I don't think we can encourage more hydro in Minnesota because we have tapped all the kinetic energy we can for hydroelectricity. So I'm not sure what the next point in the question is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I came in the middle of the conversation, so I'll listen a little bit more, and then I'll ask another question then. Yeah.
Senator Brown, then Senator Dibble.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I support what Senator Benson is trying to do in this bill. It seems to me that if we can find sources that aren't dependent on government subsidies, hence taxpayer dollars, to be affordable and to be workable, then that makes sense. And hydro is a renewable energy. I'm not sure we're arguing that, but why it wasn't included, I understand all that discussion took place, but I think we're at a point where it does need to be included. Unless we want government subsidization to go on long term. And I, for one, don't want that to happen. So I think this is a good bill, and I hope we can move it forward.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just responding, to the last point that Senator Benson made, there is opportunity for small hydro still in Minnesota.
Okay.
We saw the Brookfield development. outside of downtown Minneapolis on the river there, and there are other proposals. There's new turbine technology and to take advantage of the river currents and all kinds of new and efficient ways. So hydro is available as part of the RES and in smaller chunks than, you know, the big, huge Manitoba hydro that we've been purchasing now for many, many years. And so I understand, Madam Chair, Senator Benson, what you're trying to accomplish, and I think the testifiers have laid out the policy choices and the options and the trade-offs quite clearly. And, you know, given those policy options and those choices and the fact that we have a number of goals that we're trying to derive, environmental but also social and in terms of economic development and kind of reliable, secure energy future, those are multiple goals that kind of exist concurrently in the renewable energy standard, and I think we simply trade away some of that by moving forward with this legislation. I don't question your motives. I think they're valid. I simply disagree with them.
Senator Jungbauer. Senator Benson,
Madam Chair,
in response.
I want to thank Senator Dibble for not asking me a question because I always get nervous when you start talking.
Because we don't understand. He has an intellectual way of saying things. Repeat that. And I just have to just editorialize a little bit because this is a very, very tough position that myself and Senator Magnus are in with this bill. And just for everybody's to know, full disclosure, Senator Benson came and we talked greatly on this bill because wind has been very good for southern Minnesota, for our districts. It has been an economic driver. It has... we are using power from there, and any development, whether it's the biofuels or it's wind, has to have to get jump started some kind of government subsidy, because that's where the investment comes in. And so I tend to defend that because that has been very good for my district, for southern Minnesota, for the whole state to have this broad array of energy sources, whether they be the biofuels or renewable energy going forward. So this is a very difficult vote for me. And we did not take this lightly at all. This is not, she was very respectful, Senator Benson, with this bill. And I said, no, for a long, long time, long time, didn't I? And,
Madam Chair, if I may correct,
Senator Benson,
you didn't say no. You said, come back with more. And tell me again why you think it's a good idea. You never actually told me no, so I kept coming.
She might today.
Read between the lines, Senator Benson. I'm just joking. So I do hold some trepidation on this bill. I will be honest. This is very tough for me and for my Senate district. Senator Brown.
Just to follow up on that, I'm not opposed to initial subsidization. It's the long-term ongoing that makes me uncomfortable.
Fair enough. Oh. That's very good. And to that point, Senator Dibble?
Well, Madam Chair, I was going to make that point, and I forgot to. We actually do provide all kinds of perks and benefits, BIFs and subsidy for very traditional forms of energy today.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
right.
We can have that conversation, too.
Right.
Love to show all the subsidies for coal.
Absolutely.
And oil. We do that now.
And Senator Benson?
And just briefly to that point, because Senator Jungbauer, he's been
patient.
Trying to get it. He's been so patient. But... part of the comfort in this is that there are long-term power purchase agreements in place, so we are not immediately pulling the rug out from under existing wind projects with vested structures and capital development plans. We're looking towards the future. And when we heard the testimony on the RES, they're expiring slowly over time. And some of them quite distant into the future. And mm-hmm. so hopefully not creating too much chaos because of that structure.
I think this has been a great discussion. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, I don't know whether to go forward or backward with this argument, except that Senator Dibble was right on. I mean, there's a lot of new hydro that's multi-directional, and whether the water's high or low, we can change the turbines. We can put them in a lot of areas. However, as I would love to remind people around the RES, the reason some of us put in our vote at the last minute that hated the RES was because we got promised transmission line. And I'm sorry. I mean, wind folks, you should be
you know, getting on board with this. We were promised that if we move towards this, that you guys would help us get a lot of new transmission line that hasn't shown up. And in terms of the small hydro, too, I remember, gee, it seems like there's this city someplace close by. Let me see if I can divine which city that was. Minneapolis. And somebody's been trying to put in small hydro for, well, maybe it's a couple decades even now, that, and it seems to be 100% political and about local regulations. So we can talk about it all day long, but when people want to play games with it, it still doesn't get done. So,
Senator Dipple.
Madam Chair. Senator Grungbauer will notice that we did install new hydro in Minneapolis, yes, because it made sense in from every way you look at it. The project that you're referring to was a bad idea for a lot of reasons. So not every project conceived just because it's renewable is a good project. And local control, local regulation, public impact, and public participation are important, as are a whole lot of other things. That project was not without impact. It was with significant impact on a lot of other things. And it failed on the merits, not on politics. It failed on its merits.
Mr. Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dibble, that's interesting because many times I've heard from people in Minneapolis it failed on politics. So,
Madam Chair, I will visit Senator Jungbauer and we'll go point by point on all
the bad elements
of that project. There are a lot of them.
But, Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, when we talk about local regulations and local control and things, that's part of the reason we're not getting our transmission as well, because everybody wants the electricity, but nobody seems to want the power lines. And granted, that goes on in my district as well, because people that know that the city of East Bethel has been complaining about a power line going over a small portion of the city, and yet the citizens benefit, and this is always befuddles me, is why we want the power coming to our house, but we don't want the power line anywhere near. So it's an amazing thing, because they have to go together. So if we're going to put more renewable online, we also need that transmission. If we're not getting the transmission, we sure as heck can't. So it becomes a circular argument, and we get nowhere. And so some days I get frustrated sitting in the middle of this circular argument.
We have the A1 amendment we need to vote on. Any further questions for Mr. Bennett and Mr. Nobles? Thank you very much. Let's vote on the A1 amendment. Senator Brown, you would like to
Madam
move
Chair,
that?
I move the A1 amendment.
Senator Brown moves the A1 amendment. All those, any questions on the A1? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Gerber, the chamber, please.
Good work.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Gerber. I'm the Energy Policy Manager for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I think the discussion has been really, really interesting today, and I think we should take a step back and look at some of the logic behind what we're debating. And I think it's really important to look at this is really a protectionist policy, and we're saying, and I think we'd be a little upset if we were in the opposite position and Canada was debating something that would have a detriment to us. And I think we really have to be careful about setting policies that are going to impact our businesses and ratepayers. I mean, we have to consider that this money is coming out of the checkbooks of businesses and residential ratepayers. And we have to think about that. And Senator Benson, I'd like to thank her for bringing this bill, made a very valid point that we do purchase wind power from other states, and we count that towards the RES. So the whole idea that we're only going to create jobs in Minnesota, I think that the policy that we have in place doesn't really – if that is your objective, then we're not really – that the policy doesn't match that objective. So I think that's really important to look at. And customers support a least cost method to achieve the RES, and especially the business customers. And what this really is doing is it's subsidizing, it's picking winners and losers, and then picking winners and losers among those groups. And I think that becomes dangerous. And as you see, the groups that are testifying today, you know, they already have their carve out or mandate or whatever you want to call it, and now they don't want that taken away. And so it's just important to you know, we're not naturally an energy producing state like if you compare us to our neighbor to the north, North Dakota. And so you know, I think least cost energy is really important, and it allows us to grow jobs without subsidizing anything. And I think that's really important to recognize, that we have industries in our state where 25 to 35% of their production costs are energy. So a 1% increase in their energy costs can mean jobs and growth within the state with industries that we've been good at for over 100 years. So encouraging that growth is really important to growing those jobs within Minnesota. So thank you. I appreciate your consideration of our testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Any questions for Mr. Gerber? Thank you very much. Any questions on the bill? Any further discussion? I think it's been very good.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Metzen.
I don't think there's a need for this bill. Nobody's asking us to do it. And I'm afraid, again, of the job creation and I almost or lack thereof, maybe. And if this, I'm not going to move it to the Jobs Committee, but I'm sure some of the folks on that committee would like to look at it too. But anyway, vote no.
Further questions?
Maybe, Madam Chair? Senator, maybe we can have a roll call vote on this one.
All right. Roll call has been requested. A roll call will be taken. Senator Benson, any final words? Would you like to move the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I move Senate File 1906 to be passed to the floor. I appreciate the discussion.
As amended.
Okay. I appreciate the discussion that we have had, the respectful tone, the thoughtful tone. I think this is good policy. I think it sends a signal to the rest of the country that while we are keeping a renewable energy standard in place, our renewable energy standard is one of the highest in the country. And we're sending the signal that businesses can come here and expect us to have reliable, reasonably priced, respectful of the environment energy policy. And they will be welcome here.
Thank you. Secretary will take the roll. Chair votes yes.
Senator Rosen?
Yes.
Senator Benson?
Yes.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Hayden?
No.
Senator Howe?
Yes.
Senator Jungbauer?
Yes.
Senator Koch?
Yes.
Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator McGuire?
No.
Senator Metzen?
No.
Senator Vandeveer?
Yes.
Yeah, I just don't. Yeah.
There be 8 ayes and 4 noes. The motion prevails. The bill passes. Thank you, Senator Benson. Thank you, everybody, for this. We have next Tuesday, we have Senate File 2187, Senator Koch's resolution urging the President and the Congress to enact legislation to take over the federal government action related to interim storage of used nuclear waste fuel. So we're going to talk about what happened at Fukushima disaster and an update from the Blue Ribbon Commission. And March 8th is the RDF reform bill that's coming forward. And then we also have an energy forward pricing bill. And with that, any questions? Meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, you guys.